And a big welcome to a Juno Afternoon. Today, my name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, we're going to be learning about Saturday's Taku Winds concert. Frank Rue will be here to highlight Saturday's Wetlands Community Cleanup. Then a preview of this evening's Juno World Affairs Council presentation by Stephen Stedman. We'll talk with Andy Klein about the Alaskan Brewing Company's support of the wetlands cleanup. And finally, we'll hear from acclaimed author Kirby Larson, who is in town to visit schools and bookstores. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO Juno, repeated at 4 on KRNN.
This is National Native News. I'm Stephen Emmons, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A lawsuit against South Dakota officials for violations of the Indian Child Welfare Act is moving towards resolution. A hearing in federal court at the end of May will give Pennington County officials remedies for practices that violate ICWA. And last week, an issue over missing documents was resolved. Victoria Wicks has followed the case since it was first filed in 2013 and has this update.
ACLU Senior Staff Counsel Stephen Pivar says this case is setting precedent.
In some of the issues, it's the first of the kind in the country, including issues of whether Indian tribes can file suit to protect their rights under the Indian Child Welfare Act, whether parents can file suit as a class action. Judge Viken ruled in our favor on those issues already.
At a hearing set for May 26th in Rapid City, federal judge Jeffrey Viken will offer remedies for 7 claims he has validated. Pivar says an 8th issue still needs resolution, whether the Department of Social Services maintains custody of children longer than allowed by ICWA guidelines. One of the defendants, Judge Jeff Davis, was sued in his official capacity as presiding judge. Davis is no longer in that position and is no longer a defendant. Pivar says during the process of discovery, plaintiffs conducted research to find a missing 2012 memorandum. Pivar says plaintiffs initially asked for sanctions against Judge Davis, but after the document was recovered, plaintiffs withdrew that request.
We did not have any finding of sanctions. I want to make that clear for the sake of Judge Davis. There's no finding of wrongdoing. However, he did agree as part of the settlement to pay $50,000 in attorney's fees for the amount of time we spent litigating the issue.
That issue was resolved last week. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Also in South Dakota, the decision to rename Harney Peak in the Black Hills will have to wait until at least June. The U.S. Board on Geographic Names discussed the issue at its April meeting, but failed to come to a consensus. Executive Director Lou Yost says the board will probably take it up again at its June or July meeting. A drive to rename the peak started last year when traditional Lakota people joined with a relative of William Harney to push for the change. General Harney led U.S. troops in an 1855 massacre of Lakota people at Blue Water Creek in Nebraska. Harney Peak is the site of a sacred spring ritual for indigenous people. After holding a series of public meetings, the South Dakota Board on Geographic Names initially approved changing the name, but that board received additional opposition after public hearings had ended. There was no consensus on a new name, so the state board ultimately supported leaving the name as it is. The chief judge of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe says 10 years of wellness courts in Cass Lake, Minnesota are working. Tribal programs help those struggling with alcohol and drug abuse by addressing the wellness of a person's spirit, mind, and body by using Ojibwe culture and values. Judge Paul Day says joint tribal-state jurisdiction, first established in 2006, is part of the success at Leech Lake. He says evaluation of the tribal wellness courts show better results than traditional drug and DUI courts.
That it was evaluated on, the wellness court participants did much better than those who don't go to wellness court. In other words, their recovery was sooner, longer, faster, their staying power was better, their sentences were shorter.
Day testified about wellness courts last week at a U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs legislative hearing in Washington, D.C. Day says he supports current legislation to establish a grant program to assist tribal governments in creating tribal healing to wellness courts. For National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to the Wise Pies Arena, a.k.a. The Pit, April 29th and 30th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And our first topic on a Juno afternoon today is the upcoming spring concert of the Taku Winds. And I have two guests in the studio, Sarah McNair Grove, who's the president of the Juno Community Bands Organization, when I want to find out more about that. And also William Todd Hunt, conductor in this case for the Taku Winds, but I believe conductor for many different iterations of performance and different things over the years, correct?
Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, welcome to you both.
Yeah, thank you.
So the concert is April 23rd. Is that Saturday?
This Saturday. It's coming up pretty soon, and it's at 8 o'clock at the Jack.
And the spring concert, obviously, I'm assuming it's an annual event. There's a spring concert.
Yeah, we usually hold two concerts a year, one in the fall and one in the spring. So this is our spring one for this year.
And the Taku Winds, who is the Taku Winds? Who are the Taku Winds? What is the Taku Winds?
The Taku Winds is a wind ensemble, which means it consists of players who play wind instruments, clarinets, flutes, saxophones, trumpets, French horns, tubas, trombones, and percussion, those kinds of instruments. We don't have any strings, although we do have one bass. But it's generally not a string group.
Yeah.
And most of the players are adult players who enjoy playing. Some of them also play in the symphony, but we also have more that do not. And we have a couple of high school players that are playing with us this time as well.
Mm-hmm. And how long has the Taku Winds been an entity, a performing entity?
Oh, I should know this right off, but I don't. I think probably about 8 years we've been around. We've had sort of different names, but as a group, as a concert band that plays, we've been around probably about 8 years.
Yeah. And Todd, have you always been involved with the Taku Winds?
I have. Well, actually, I just played, I think, on the very first concert, or did I conduct it? I don't even remember now. I typically conduct one of the two concerts a year, sometimes play, but yeah. So, yeah, I've been doing a lot with these guys.
And then, Sarah, are you a performer as well?
I'm a performer as well. I play clarinet.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're also here with your hat on as the president of the Juno Community Bands organization.
Right. The Juno Community Bands is really the organization that sponsors Taku Winds. We also have a couple of other wind groups. Probably the best known is the Juno Volunteer Marching Band that gets together just for the 4th of July parades. We sponsor that. Christmas time, we have a little reindeer band that goes around and plays Christmas carols at various venues. And we have other small ensembles as the need arises. But our two most active are the Taku Winds Wind Ensemble and the marching band.
And these musicians, this is all volunteer, love of music, giving to the community and getting to perform and what have you. So the concert, 8 o'clock this Saturday at the Jack. Tell us about what's on the program.
Yeah, so the big piece on the program, and if you've seen the posters around town, it's Pictures at an Exhibition, which some of you might know it as an orchestra piece. It was actually originally a piano piece by Mazursky that Ravel orchestrated, and so it became the stupidly famous orchestra piece.
Wonderfully famous.
Yeah, okay. Wonderfully famous.
For the general public.
Ridiculously famous. Anyway, there's lots of tunes and music in that piece that you'll recognize, I think, very easily. It's, when I say it's the big work on the program, it's about half an hour long, all told. So it's a significant... significant thing. And, of course, we're doing it in a band version of that, which is based, I think, mostly on that orchestral version that we know so well. So there's actually a lot of sort of familiar sounds in that way, too. So also on the program, we have a world premiere of a piece by our bassoon player, Artemio Sandoval, who done one other of his pieces about a year ago. So he's one of our young up-and-coming composers, and we enjoy having that energy in our group and being able to bring new music to folks. Also on the program, and a lot of people are really excited about this, we're doing a medley from The Force Awakens, the new Star Wars.
Oh boy.
So, that's got a lot of people really pumped about that. And we also have a lot of our concerts will include young players, like middle school, sometimes elementary school players. This time we have kids from the Montessori program and the charter school joining us for a piece. And that is a really nice kind of community outreach, because we get to they get to sit in with maybe not pros, but, people who've been playing this a long time, and sort of get to hear what a more advanced group sounds like. And I think that pretty much all of them end up getting really jazzed about playing.
Yeah. I bet. How does that work? How do the younger musicians get involved?
Well, in this case, we've got Amy Bibb is the music teacher for them. And she's like, hey, I think, we should have my kids come and join. I'm like, sure.
Mm-hmm.
You pick a piece and, we'll do it.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
So rehearsals, volunteers and, mm-hmm. Everybody's got busy lives, and you're talking about a 30-minute long piece. And so how do you carve out the time? How's it going?
So it's been going well. We typically, and actually this is good for everybody to listen to if you have an instrument in your closet and you once played at one time. We're always looking for players. I would say we're especially looking for some things, but really, I don't think there's anything we're just like totally turning people away for. We rehearse once a week, typically Saturday mornings, 10 to noon. The concert week, we rehearse a little bit more just to kind of get the ball rolling. But it's a pretty low impact on people's schedules, and that's how we get so many folks to want to do this numerous times a year.
So how many musicians on the stage on Saturday do we?
Roughly 25, I think.
Uh-huh.
So it's a nice group.
And the length of the overall program, is it?
An hour.
Probably an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we've also done is, since the piece we're playing is pictures at an exhibition, we have asked some of the elementary school music classes to provide us with some pictures.
Oh, fun.
So we're having our own Juno pictures at an exhibition, and we really have quite a few pictures. So the walls of the
Jack
are
going to be... Do you have them already? So you've got them.
We have the pictures, and the walls of the Jack are just going to be plastered with these elementary school kids' pictures. So we're playing the smaller pieces at the beginning, then we're going to have an intermission so people can be sure to go and enjoy these wonderful pieces of artwork that the kids have drawn. And then after the intermission, there will be the huge pictures being performed. So it should be fun.
Any narration, any presentation about along with the pieces, or is it pretty much just getting up and introducing and launching into it?
Typically what I do during a concert is I'll sort of talk about each piece before it happens.
Yeah.
I don't usually think about it much before I get up there and do it, so I have no idea what I'm going to say. Probably with the pictures in an exhibition, I'll talk about it first. And then just goes straight through, because a lot of the movements feel like they need to flow from one to the other, so I won't interrupt them with yammering. But there'll be sort of program notes done live.
Yeah. So anything else about the music, about the program itself, that you wanted to highlight today for people?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just a really accessible program that that folks will enjoy. It's got kind of, I think, something for everybody. And it's your friends and neighbors playing.
Good old Juno.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah, anything else you wanted to add about it and or the Juno community bands?
No, just hope that you'll come out. It's going to be a really fun evening.
Yeah.
And they say you'll hear good music, you'll see fun pictures, and just have a good time. So it's Saturday at 8 o'clock at the Jack.
And this is the annual spring concert of the Taku Winds, and Sarah McNair-Grove and Todd Hunt, thank you very much, both of you, for coming in.
Thanks
for having us.
And our next guest in the studio is Alex Wertheimer. And Alex is the board president of the Southeast Alaska Land Trust. Is that correct? Did I get that right? Mm-hmm. So Frank Rue was going to be here, but Frank could not make it. So thanks for coming in at the last moment here.
Now, Frank is a victim of this Juno crud that's going around. He didn't want to spend this entire time coughing on the air.
Well, we appreciate that, and on a beautiful sunny day, I'm sorry for him. I was hoping he was out hiking on a trail or something, but apparently not. So you folks are on Saturday. You're doing the Juneau Wetlands Community Cleanup.
Right, and it's a collaborative effort. We're partnering with the Alaska Brewing Company, Juneau Audubon, Discovery Southeast, Alaska Geographic, Litter Free, and Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
And this is an annual event, I think.
Right, right.
And, how many years have you been doing it?
This is the third year running now. And last year, just I can give you a few stats from last year, the same group of people with some help from North Star Trekking, we removed over 3,000 pounds of trash from the wetlands and from the estuary at Ocknoo, including 400 pounds of recyclables, and North Star Trekking pulled a helicopter heli load of 800 pounds out of the middle of the refuge. So we're hoping maybe it'll be a little less this year. We're hoping we made a dent in it, but you know how that stuff is renews itself.
So this is different from the Litter Free program. I realize they're a partner here, but Litter Free, I think they're pretty much cleaning up the roadway system every year. But in this case, you folks are focused on the wetlands proper.
Right, the wetlands and the Audubon group they're going to be at Auk Rec area. They're going to have a bird walk and focus on that coastal area around the Auk recreational area. One of the reasons that, in particular, that Seal Trust is focused on the wetlands is that we are involved with acquiring a lot of the accreted lands around the wetlands as one of our functions as a land trust to try and get that land in conservation status so ultimately it can be added to the refuge. This accreted land is land that due to the rising, the isostatic rebound and rising land, the adjacent property owners acquire that land or have title to it. And often they are quite willing, we work with willing buyers to put it into a conservation status to maintain their viewscape and to contribute to that refuge area.
And the isostatic rebound, that's because of the ice sheet. The ice has melted off over the last couple of hundred years, and we're seeing this thousands of years.
Right.
Yeah,
and
so that's what that is.
So that weight of the ice off the land. One reason Southeast Alaska is not going to suffer from rising sea level is that our land is rising faster than the sea level is.
Right. So let's talk just a little bit of detail about the event itself. I mean, I know you've got your network of people who probably know about this already. Are you looking for more volunteers? Are you
definitely
looking for people to show up?
Definitely want volunteers. And there's two locations. One is to meet at 7083 Hendrickson Road. That's right near the Sunny. That's on Sunny Point, getting off at the Sunny Point turnoff. And you go under the Egan Drive underpass, under Sunny Drive, take a second left under Henderson Road, and that's the home of Frank and Sally Rue, and they're going to host a small breakfast and gathering and sort of bring everybody together there to disperse trash bags and have people pick areas that they want to head out to clean up in the wetlands. The other is at Auk Rec area at 8 o'clock. And that will be the naturalist-guided birding walk and the coastal cleanup, and the Juneau Audubon people will be there for that. And I assume it's at the main shelter they meet. I don't have it specifically written down here, but I assume that's where it'll be.
And so for people who are maybe hearing this for the first time and are thinking about it, if they want to go online and get the same information, you folks have a website?
It is. It's at our website at southeastalaskalandtrust.org. It'll be on there. And after the cleanup, I figure the cleanup will run until about 11:30, the Alaska Brewing Company, which is also partnering in this, and they cover the wetlands south of Sunny Point down towards their native watershed there. They're going to be hosting a party for people over 21. I think you're going to have Andy Klein on in a little bit, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you can talk in a lot more detail about that.
Oh, he's good at talking, yeah. how many people are you hoping to have? I mean, how many people?
Well, last year we had over 70 volunteers.
Yeah.
Which is nice when you're dragging out 3,000 pounds of trash. The numbers make the job a little bit easier.
You know, this is, may sound, I don't mean this as a kind of a stupid question. This is a serious question. Why bother? What's the value? I mean, for me, I get it. Picking up trash is something I wouldn't think twice about doing. But in this case, the wetlands, you have a serious effort here to try to maintain a certain level of cleanliness.
Well, of course, just for aesthetic value, it's worth it in that alone. But then there's also the fact that a lot of this trash can jeopardize wildlife, waterfowl. They can ingest plastics. They can get ensnared in wire. And so there's also that value. And then some are direct pollutants. You pick up old batteries, treated lumber, materials like that can put toxins into the wetlands, and we're counting on those wetlands as filters and purifiers and as part of their ecological function. So we want to help them the best we can.
You know, the wetlands is used by a lot of people. I imagine there's a lot of different user groups. I mean, there's people who walk, there's people who hunt, there's people who are recreating out in the wetlands.
Absolutely.
And it's a fairly large area. So in the cleanup, are you looking to focus on kind of the most heavily used areas, or do you just you try to cover every single inch of the quote unquote wetlands?
Well, the heavily used areas are, for two reasons. One, they're easier to get to,
yeah.
And then two, they're where you're going to probably find the most debris. And last year, we did make an effort to get out in the middle and gather as much trash as possible, and that's where we really appreciated the efforts of North Star Trekking to help us out in terms of removing that, putting a cargo net out there. So we'll just do what's in the range of the number of volunteers we have.
Mm-hmm. Anything else about – I want to ask you a little bit more about the Southeast Alaska Land Trust and your activities, but anything else about the event itself that you wanted to make sure people knew about?
Well, we're hoping to have weather like this.
Oh, it'll be great.
That would really help us go along. And the forecast is actually pretty good for Saturday, so we encourage people to show up and give a hand. They should rubber boots and gloves are definitely a good idea. It is the wetlands, and things can be soggy out there.
Great form of exercise. Great thing to do with community members cleaning up the wetlands. So just with a minute or two here left, the Southeast Alaska Land Trust, for people who really don't know about the organization, give a thumbnail sketch of what you folks do.
Sure. Our land trust is here in Southeast Alaska. It's headquartered here in Juneau, is one of over 1,200 land trusts nationwide, and we are an accredited member of the Land Trust Alliance. Our mission is to cooperate with the communities in Southeast Alaska, the landowners, and others to ensure habitat, recreation, open space, historical areas remain in place for the well-being of each generation. So we either purchase land outright or with conservation easements or accept land donations to protect important ecological, scenic, recreational, or historical values, and then provide stewardship on those properties to ensure the conservation values are maintained. And I like to look at it as a win-win situation in that we're working with willing buyers or landowners that want to either sell land to put it in a conservation status or see their own property with a conservation easement maintain in perpetuity the values that they hold so highly.
How long has the trust been active here in Juneau?
I believe it's 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my tenure is the last 5 years, so I can get a little fuzzy on the historical stuff.
And for people who are interested, and can people get involved? Can people be volunteers with the trust? I mean, what kind of there's so many organizations that people can get involved with here in the capital city. Is this one of them?
There is opportunities for involvement. For one thing, there's opportunities to belong to the land trust as a member to help support our mission. And that the information about doing that is available, again, at our website, southeastalaskalandtrust.org. a lot of information there also about, you know, what land trusts are, how we go about doing what we do, and the properties that we have protected so far. We have 30 properties now over, let me see, the acreage is over 3,300 acres of land in stewardship status with the Southeast Alaska Land Trust. So, yeah, there's opportunities to support us directly with membership and also volunteer opportunities. For instance, we have to have stewardship visits to our properties on a regular basis, and sometimes volunteers are encouraged to go on those, especially in the local areas, to basically back up the conservation specialist and to see the properties that we have under stewardship status.
We've been learning about the Southeast Alaska Land Trust here and also about their is this the third annual or fourth annual community wetlands cleanup?
I'm going with third.
We'll go with third. So the Juneau Wetlands Community Cleanup, which is this Saturday, and you want people meeting at the Sunny Point site at 8 o'clock
it's
in the morning?
Let's see. My number's right here. 7083 Hendrickson Road. And that would be at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there'll be some breakfast goodies available, and as well as cleanup bags and directions. And the other site is the Naturalist Guided Birding Walk and Coastal Cleanup that Juneau Audubon is undertaking, and that meet for that at 8 o'clock at the Auk Rec area.
Very good. Alex, anything else that you want to pass on about this event and or the land trust before we go?
I think we covered it.
Well, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in, and I hope Frank's feeling better.
All right. Thanks, Jamie.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 20th of April, 2016. It was on this date in 1841, Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Murders in the Rue Morgue, first appeared in a magazine, now considered the first modern detective story. Poe himself was the editor of the magazine, story in which a mother and daughter have been brutally murdered in a fourth-floor room that was locked from the inside. And the detective, Monsieur Auguste Dupin, solves the crime. The murder was committed by an orangutan who was armed with a straight razor and who scaled the building and came in through the window. Dupin appeared again in two more stories by Poe, The Mystery of Marie Roget and The Purloined Letter, and he is considered to have inspired many other literary detectives, Hercule Poirot of Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes of Arthur Conan Doyle. It's the birthday of the sculptor Daniel Chester French, Exeter, New Hampshire, 1850, who did, among other things, the seated figure of Abraham Lincoln at the Lincoln Memorial. He was a self-taught sculptor. It's the birthday of the novelist Sebastian Faulks, Donington, England, 1953, who read Dickens and D.H. Lawrence when he was a boy, decided to be a novelist, spent a year studying in Paris. Sebastian Faulks said, at that time, France was a very old-fashioned country. You could branch off any main road in any of the provinces, and in 5 minutes you would be back in the 1930s. So when he started writing novels, he set his novels in France, mostly in the 30s and the 40s, The Girl at the Lion d'Or and Birdsong and Charlotte Gray. Here's a poem for today by Billy Collins, The Sand Hill Cranes of Nebraska. Too bad you weren't here 6 months ago, was a lament I heard on my visit to Nebraska. You could have seen the astonishing spectacle of the Sand Hill Cranes, thousands of them, feeding and even dancing on the shores of the Platte River. There was no point in pointing out the impossibility of my being there then because I happened to be somewhere else. So I nodded and put on a look of mild disappointment, if only to be part of the commiseration. It was the same look I remember wearing about 6 months ago in Georgia when I was told that I had just missed the spectacular annual outburst of azaleas, brilliant against the green backdrop of spring, and the same in Vermont, 6 months before that, when I arrived shortly after the magnificent foliage had gloriously peaked, Mother Nature, as she is called, having touched the hills with her many-colored brush, a phenomenon that occurs, like the others, around the same time every year, when I am, apparently, off in another state, stuck in a motel lobby with the local paper and a styrofoam cup of coffee, busily missing God knows what. The Sandhill Cranes of Nebraska by Billy Collins from his collection Aimless Love, published by Random House and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. And by TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
And I would like to welcome into the studio Jim Clark, who's the board president of the Juneau World Affairs Council, and their special guest, Steve Stedman, who's in town, who's going to be speaking this evening here at KTOO. It's a monthly presentation. Is that correct, Jim?
It's whenever we can get a good speaker, and we have a very good speaker for tonight.
And this is tonight. So if you're thinking a lot of these interviews are things coming up this weekend, but this is tonight. So this is like after work. If you're downtown, you can just stay downtown. The presentation is right here at 360 here in the KTOO building, so file that away. It starts at 5 o'clock. And Jim, why don't you just briefly talk about the Juneau World Affairs Council, and then we'll start talking to Steve.
Well, the Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that devotes itself to bringing quality speakers on international issues to Juneau. And as I mentioned, we get them whenever they can, but I certainly would invite everyone to just take an hour tonight, notwithstanding how pretty it is outside, and enjoy Steve's talk.
Have you been trying to get Steve for a long time?
Actually, yes. It's been about an 8 or 9 month process, but we finally have him.
So, Steve, let me just read here a little bit of an introduction to get the title correct. But you're a senior fellow and deputy director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at Stanford University.
Yes.
Is that correct?
It's a mouthful.
Well, there's several other titles that go along with your name as well, but that seemed to be the one that, you know, captured it perhaps the best. And I also noted that your research interests include international organizations and global security, civil wars, mediation, conflict prevention, and peacekeeping. It's a kind of a fascinating, very current, present tense kind of realm of interest that you have about politics on an international level. And when I think about your title, this Deputy Director of the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law, what is that? What are you doing? What are you working on?
So I'm working on several things right now, but most relevant to the talk tonight is that about 20 years ago, we started noticing that most wars in the world were within countries, within borders, not between countries. And we didn't really understand what the international implications of those wars were going to be. We had this view that a civil war somewhere over in Africa, you know, it doesn't really pertain to us. Once again, recently with what's going on in the Middle East, we're seeing all kinds of spillover effects, ramifications of those civil wars, of those internal conflicts, and how they affect international security, global security. So I'm going to be touching on some of that tonight, but I'm also going to be talking about the gap between American perceptions of threats to security and what we know about the real world, that is, threats and fears, and how sometimes they're misaligned.
How did you come to this line of work? I don't think this is the kind of thing that as a high school student you say, I'm going to end up studying in that realm or that space. So a little bit about your background and your kind of journey to get to this point of expertise.
Sure. Actually, talking to Jim earlier, Jim turns out served in Vietnam. My dad served in Vietnam two tours, and that's when I was in high school, middle school and high school. And for me, it prompted this big question about why in Vietnam, for instance, would you have a war that would last 20 years and, you know, 58,000 deaths on the United States side, a million casualties overall. Wasn't there any space to negotiate at all, right? You know, couldn't somebody have done something short of all that killing, right? And that just set off my career, basically, both as an undergraduate and graduate school, trying to understand what drives parties in civil wars and international intervention. And is it always the case that there's no room for compromise? Or are there possibilities for mediation? Are there possibilities of ending these wars short of one side simply eliminating the other or winning an all-out victory? So it actually goes back to my experience and our family's experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, so you do research, you study, you have a group, and but then you have results, you have products. I mean, you have things that you've been involved with doing to try to bring solutions or to advance problem solving. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So we were some of the first people to be looking at peacemaking and civil wars. And this was in the 1990s when UN peacekeeping and civil wars took off. And I was an early critic of UN peacekeeping and civil wars, a sympathetic critic, just to say, you know, a sympathetic critic, that if they could do it better, that would be great. After about 15 years of publishing all kinds of research results about how they could do it better, they actually asked me to come to the UN and spend 2 years working on various problems of international security to see if there were ways of trying to improve the United Nations and make it more relevant to the 21st century. So I went from academia to 2 years working for Kofi Annan in the United Nations. Came out of that experience wanting to sort of be a bridge builder between U.S. foreign policy and international institutions. And so I've pretty much been working on that ever since. So I do a lot of work on U.S. foreign policy, a lot of work on international organizations. How can you improve them? How can the U.S. government get more out of international institutions to get the kind of cooperation it needs internationally? So that's how it's sort of the evolution of my career and the interaction with policy.
And there's probably a lot of different things you would like to try or to see implemented to improve these relations, but are there a couple in general or primary ones that you would want people to think about or be aware of? Things that I noticed the electoral integrity of democracies and a few things that were referenced in the literature that, you know, on your website and what have you. So speak a little bit to those things.
Oh, sure. This was a separate experience where about 5 years ago, my former boss at the UN, Kofi Annan, was named the chair of a global commission on how to best protect and promote the integrity of elections worldwide. And so he asked me to direct that. And so we spent 2 years looking at research, but also going to troubled places, studying troubled elections, trying to figure out, you know, what are the keys to getting elections with integrity. And some of the most interesting things, of course, is looking inwards, right, and taking the standards that we had internationally for what was an election with integrity and asking questions about American elections, right? Are we meeting global standards? And actually on several things we're not. So actually, if I could, you know, if I could change the world tomorrow, that would be one of the places I would start. I would actually start by revamping and reforming American elections, because there are important implications for how we govern ourselves, how we interact with the world, and how we can best be international leaders, right? When we fail with our democratic governance, first of all, people notice outside of our country. They notice when we fail with our internal governance. But it also weakens us in terms of trying to get the cooperation that we need internationally.
And is this part of your talk tonight? Are you touching on this subject matter as well, or is
No, I'm happy to answer questions.
In the Q&A part of the program.
Yeah, I mean,
with our elections right now, everybody's immersed in thinking about elections and our own electoral process. So it's interesting to hear you reference America's system in that way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that sort of spurred the talk I'm going to give tonight is, for instance, the rhetoric of decline. And the rhetoric that the world is falling apart, we're falling apart, American foreign policy is falling apart, everything's falling apart, right? And how many of the candidates are using the narrative, we want to make America great again. And I find all this troubling because actually on a whole bunch of different dimensions, the world is not falling apart. The world is much better off today than it was 30 years ago. And on any dimension you want to pretty much devise. American power, we're still the most powerful country in the world, right? Are there challenges? Yes. Are there threats to our security? Yes. But it seems so much of our political rhetoric is based on fear and trying to engage in a politics of fear that really leads to irrational policies, I think.
And then just last question, and then I will see if you've got more you want to add just about tonight's presentation to pique people's interest in coming. Kind of just globally, trending-wise, does the world seem to you to be coming increasingly more democratic, less democratic, about the same?
Well, if you go back, if you take the long view of the last 50 years, there's been a threefold growth in the number of democracies in the world. I mean, just staggering growth of democracies in continents that we thought would never have democracy, in places that are so poor that we thought would never have democracy. Now, if you shorten the time horizon and just say, this is the last 10 years, the peak was probably about 2004, 2005, and there has been a slight retreat in some important places. Turkey is less democratic than it was, you know, several years ago. Russia is becoming more autocratic. So there are a number of troubled places. But overall, you should not miss the big picture. The big picture is this is so much more of a democratic world than it was in 1990, which was more democratic than it was in 1975, than it was in 1960. You know.
Anything else about tonight's presentation you'd like people to think about or know about? And if they're like not sure if they're going to swing by and catch your presentation or not.
Well, I think I'm going to be going to this problem about what are the threats to international security? What are the threats to global security? And what do we fear? And is there a good match between what we're told we should fear and what really are the threats out there?
Mm-hmm.
Because if there isn't, then we got a real problem.
Right. Very good. We've been listening to Steve Stedman, who is the Deputy Director of the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, and he is the guest speaker, the person who's making the presentation this evening for the Juno World Affairs Council. Stephen, a pleasure meeting you. Thanks. It's fascinating subject matter, and I appreciate you being here in Juneau. I'm glad you came to Alaska and for our benefit. And Jim Clark, as always, thanks to JWAC for bringing people to Alaska. Nice to meet you both.
Thank you.
And Jamie, just to remind everybody, 5 o'clock tonight at the 360 studio.
Yeah, right.
And thanks very much.
You're welcome, right here at KTOO.
This is Bird Note. In his book, Welcome to Suburbia, John Marsloff offers a guide to living in proximity to birds and other wildlife. He's a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington in Seattle. And here are his 10 commandments for happy coexistence with nature and birds in particular.
The first is, do not covet your neighbor's lawn. The lawn is really an ecological disaster of the highest magnitude. Second one is to keep your cats indoors. Thirdly, make your windows visible to birds. Fourthly, don't light up the night sky. Fifth, provide food, water, and nest boxes, other provisions that birds need. Sixth, do not kill native predators. Seven, foster a diversity of habitats within the cities where we live. Eighth, make the roads safer for wildlife and crossings of hazardous places in general safer. And nine, work with planning authorities to try to ensure that we have functional connections, those that are useful to animals between aquatic and terrestrial places in our cities. And finally, number 10 is to enjoy and bond with nature wherever you live. And that's very important because engaging with nature allows people to appreciate nature, build respect for it, care, wonder, and even love for nature.
For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
And I'm happy to welcome into the studio Andy Klein with the Alaskan Brewing Company. And they're involved with the wetlands cleanup this weekend. We just spoke with Alex Wertheimer earlier about the community cleanup of the wetlands. And so we don't need to spend a lot of time talking about the cleanup proper, but you folks have a role here, partly the sponsorship and there's some activities and events. But the thing I wanted to talk about the most was just the fact that Alaskan Brewing Company has this coastal code. Why don't you tell people what coastal code is?
So that was that's essentially a trust or a fund that we set up as a portion of all the sales that we make on our ICBA IPA. So 1% of all the sales, all of our proceeds for ICBA IPA go into this coastal code trust. And then once a year, we go through a process of deciding how we're going to grant out that money. Last year, we granted out over $40,000 to organizations, and the focus on the organizations that we look for are ones that are looking to do coastal cleanup. So we've done stuff all the way from California coasts all the way up through Alaska. This next year, we're going to be doing a major cleanup. In fact, it's happening next weekend as well, this upcoming weekend as well in Washington State. And then we're participating in this as part of the Coastal Code, but we've also got other grants that are going out as part of that as well. So this wetlands cleanup that we're doing on for celebration of Earth Day happening on Saturday we're not using funds from the Coastal Code for that, but it's part of the idea of the Coastal Code. Clean up your wetlands, clean up your coast to keep the coastlines clean in this, you know, beautiful, pristine place that we live.
So, and just the history of this, I mean, when did it start?
Started in 2007.
The reason why I'm asking is I had my share of IPA over the years.
And you've done your part.
But I didn't know. And now I know that every time I'm drinking one of those IPAs, I'm actually coming through the generosity here and the, you know. So
Tastes that much better, doesn't it?
It tastes that much better. But so Alaskan Brewing Company, you know, hats off to you for doing this. I think it's important for people to understand that there's this community support thing here that the company is doing.
Yeah, we had a group of people in 2007 when we first put out Alaskan IPA, is what it was called at the time. We reformulated it a little bit a couple years ago to Icy Bay IPA. You know, we have a surfer from Yakutat on the cover of the can and the bottle. And we thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to really make that connection, make that really deep connection to this thing that, like, people in the lower 48 don't even realize, that guys up, these crazy people go and surf in this frigid water in the winter of all times, you know. But they do. And, you know, Jimmy Mahan's one of them, right? They're up there in Yakutat all the time. And so it just felt like the right time to do to just sort of, you know, it was a point where the company was mature enough that it said, we want to, you know, we really want to kind of stake a claim here of saying this is something that's important to us.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so real quickly, the details on what you guys are doing this
Saturday.
So our
little piece of the Juno, of the cleanup that's coming up, is the wetlands cleanup. So we're asking people to come see us at Sunny Point. It's sort of the dead end pullout right there by Sunny Point. And we're going to be out there from 8 to 11:30 in the morning on Saturday morning. And if you come out, we'll give you a bracelet. And if you later at noon come by the brewery with that bracelet, we're going to buy you a barbecue lunch from Fat Mo's, and then we're going to allow you to be first in line to get that day's brand new release of Raspberry Wheat, because it's Raspberry Wheat Day on Saturday when we issue out maybe the most popular local beer, and the one that people actually line up for outside the brewery and camp out for in extreme cases, and make sure that they get in line to have a keg for a wedding and that sort of stuff. That happens all the time during Raspberry Wheat season. So it's not just Raspberry Wheat Day, but it's also a barbecue happening. Fat Mo's is going to be there, and that's starting at 12 p.m., and you'll get free barbecue if you've participated in the cleanup, and you do that just by stopping by where we are cleaning up at Sunny Point, and we'll get you a bracelet, and that gets you into the fun party at the brewery starting at noon.
So just real quickly, 30 seconds here, Raspberry Wheat.
Yes.
Talk about it real quickly. If people don't know.
Yeah, so we use delicious, fresh, organic raspberries, and we add that to a base of wheat beer. It's about 6.5% alcohol. It's got a very tart raspberry flavor. It's not sweet, not overly sweet. It's got a more tart, drying finish to it. And, I mean, it's delicious, you know. That's all I can say about it. And it's just sort of a harbinger of summer and spring. It's one of those things, when raspberry wheat's out, it means summer's here. And, you know, a day like today,
summer is here.
It's not hard to see.
Andy Klein, good to see you.
Thanks,
and
Jamie.
Thanks to the Alaskan Brewing Company for supporting so many groups in the capital city, in this case, the wetlands.
Yeah, and we'd
actually
like to thank Southeast Alaska Land Trust for allowing us to be part of this really great effort that's happening on Saturday.
Good to see you.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
Glacier Valley Rotary Club presents the 2016 Pillars of America Speaker Series with Tiana Tozer on Wednesday, April 27th. At age 20, Tozer was hit by an intoxicated driver and lost the use of her legs. During her recovery, she became a member of the USA Women's Wheelchair Basketball Team, competing in the 1992 and 1996 Paralympics. Through her personal story and humor, she encourages audiences to look beyond the label. Tiana Tozer, noon at Centennial Hall, April 27th. Information and tickets at Hearthside Books.
And we're coming to the end of a Juneau afternoon today. Let's see, real quickly, weather forecast looks pretty darn nice out the window in downtown Juneau. Look, what they're telling me here on the weather forecast looks promising through the rest of today. And actually, the next several days, there may be a little bit of rain, this, that, and the other, but there's some more mostly cloudy days coming up. So on balance, some nice spring weather perhaps. So tomorrow on a Juneau afternoon, let's see, we're going to be getting a preview of this year's Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival with Reggie Shop. Andrea Campbell and Maria Lovashuk will be here highlighting the upcoming Empty Bowls fundraising banquet. I believe that's this coming Sunday. Going to get the details about Thursday's teeny post office concert at Kindred Post. And Nancy Jaturny will be here with Arts Up. That's tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juneau afternoon right here on KTOO. In Juneau, and it's I think you can hear it again at 4 o'clock on KRNN, and it's available online on demand at ktoo.org as well. And as always, a big thank you to Jeff Brown for producing, running the board here on a Juneau afternoon. Much appreciated. Scott Burton, good to see you.
Jamie, it is good to see you.
You are a busy man. What's up?
I am getting ready for All Things Considered.
Excellent program.
Awesome international, national, local news from Dominique Johnson and the local news crew coming in.
News of the day, high quality NPR, local news and information, something that so many people rely upon here at KTOO. And, of course, it's fundraising week.
It is.
It's the time of year when we're asking people who listen. If you just listen to a Juneau.